This podcast comes to you from the Wicketgate magazine, which is part of the ministry of the Reformed Baptist Church, Inverness, Scotland. The lecture you're about to hear was given by the pastor of the church, Dr. Nick Needham, and was given in two parts. This podcast is the second of the two. The title of the lecture is Golden Mouth, The Life and Times of John Chrysostom.
I'm saying that by the year 398 there was no preacher in the Eastern Greek-speaking half of the empire more celebrated than John in Antioch. Now that year, Nectarius, the bishop of Constantinople, the capital city, died. The new emperor, Arcadius, son of Theodosius, who died 3 years previously, needed a new bishop for his imperial capital. The struggle within the church between different factions in Constantinople to get their candidate elected as Nectarius' successor was fierce, highly politicized, and simmering with plots, conspiracy, and intrigue. However, the emperor, advised by his chief minister, the eunuch Eutropius, already had his eye on John. Eutropius had heard John preach in Antioch. His golden-mouthed eloquence had convinced Eutropius that this was the man who would bring glory to the Church of the Eastern Capital, the Church of the Holy Wisdom, as it was called. To prevent the citizens of Antioch raising a riotous protest against the loss of their favourite preacher, Emperor Arcadius sent troops to Antioch. The governor of the city then invited the unsuspecting John to visit a chapel with him outside the city walls. And there, the imperial troops virtually kidnapped John and escorted him to Constantinople. John protested, but as Eutropius had forecast, the people of Constantinople were overjoyed at the thought of having the East's most famous preacher as their bishop. So John submitted and was ordained to his new office. Arcadius's actions in securing John as Bishop of Constantinople shows how the Christian emperors of the East had started behaving as virtual heads of the church. Arcadius had reduced the role of the people in choosing their new bishop to merely assenting to his own imperial choice. John proved as popular a preacher in Constantinople as he had been in Antioch. The mass of ordinary people in the imperial capital became passionately attached to him. On one Sunday, when John unexpectedly did not preach, but invited a visiting bishop from Galatia to take his place, the vast congregation streamed out of the church in protest. They wanted to hear John and would put up with no substitutes. As he had in Antioch, John preached a series of expository sermons in Constantinople, which have survived in written form. The Acts of the Apostles, 55 sermons, Philippians, 15 sermons, Colossians, 5 sermons, 1 and 2 Thessalonians, 16 sermons, Philemon, 3 sermons, and Hebrews, 34 sermons. There were also many sermons for the festival days of the church, sermons prompted by personal or political circumstances, and a new type of sermon, the official sermon on a state occasion, when the imperial court were among the audience. Once again, John did not shirk from pressing home on the affluent worshippers of Constantinople their social obligations to the poor. And once again, this made him some enemies among the wealthy who did not like what they were hearing. They were especially outraged by something John said in his exposition of Colossians, when he criticized rich Christian ladies who had their toilet utensils made from solid silver as though their excrement deserved special treatment, while all around them their poverty-stricken sisters and brothers in Christ were scantily dressed and shivering in the cold of Constantinople. John apologized a few days later for using such crude language in a sermon, but no doubt he was upset that people could be more scandalized by his blunt speaking than they were by the appalling plight of the poor. Such utterances from the Ambo, however, only endeared John to the common people. Here was a true bishop, they felt, who loved them and understood their lives. John was something of a reformer as Bishop of Constantinople. The first thing he did was overhaul the finances of his new church, putting an end to the lavish banquets his predecessor had habitually thrown. The result was a substantial saving in money, which John devoted to caring for the destitute. There was already a Christian hospital attached to the church, and John channeled new funds into it, as well as building several new hospitals. He also founded a special hospital for lepers outside the city walls near the river Lysos. There were also numerous Christian-operated houses for the poor and homeless in Constantinople, and as bishop, John was in charge of these too, supporting them to the limit of his resources. John showed himself committed to evangelism, as well as caring for the church's poor. In addition to his own sermons in the Church of the Holy Wisdom, which often had an evangelistic element, he also directed efforts at evangelizing the pagan peasants of Thrace, the province of the empire where Constantinople was situated. In particular, he encouraged wealthy property owners to build churches in the countryside rather than shopping centres, baths and taverns. John also focused a special endeavour on evangelising the Germanic barbarian tribe of the Goths, many of whom had settled in Constantinople. Now the Goths were Arians, Christian in a sense, but not believing in the deity of Christ. John gave them a church for their own use, on condition that it be staffed by Orthodox Trinitarian clergy, and he made sure that the clergy learned and used the Gothic language. Sometimes John himself preached in the Gothic church in Greek with an interpreter. We're told that these missionary efforts among the Goths of Constantinople resulted in the conversion of many from Arianism to an Orthodox Trinitarian faith. We should also glance at how John introduced new religious events into the worship life of Constantinople. Let me briefly mention two elements of his innovations here. First, he introduced special nighttime services. These had been in vogue in Antioch, and John transplanted them into the imperial capital. They involved gathering to worship God during the nocturnal hours, sometimes throughout the whole night, and at least partly, it seems, in the open air. John waxed eloquent on the spiritual benefits of worshipping in the period of darkness and silence, when the mind is raised up to the awesome glory of the Creator by contemplating the 10,000 stars that spangle the night sky. And then second, John introduced religious processions in which hymns were sung proclaiming the deity of Christ. These processions were John's response to similar acts of worship by the Arians of Constantinople, who would process through the city singing blasphemous hymns that denied Christ's deity. John got his congregation to adopt the practice, but in the service of Trinitarian orthodoxy. Once, we are told, the two processions, Orthodox and Arian, clashed, resulting in a bloody street battle with casualties on both sides. The people of Constantinople obviously got very worked up about their religion. Now, one of the most important aspects of John's new life as Bishop of Constantinople was the new personal relationships he made there, which were to influence him deeply. We can look at two in particular. First of all, attached to the Church of the Holy Wisdom was a special dwelling for Christian ladies who had decided to devote themselves to the single life. This was by no means an easy thing, socially and economically, in the culture of the Roman Empire. As we've seen, it was one reason why a celibate Christian woman might put herself under the protection of a celibate Christian man in a spiritual partnership, something John did not approve of. But another option was for single women to club together, as it were, as a sort of spiritual sisterhood and support each other. Such a sisterhood existed in Constantinople, its abode next to John's church. There were some 250 single Christian ladies in residence, and they were presided over by a quite remarkable woman named Olympias. Olympias was from a stupendously wealthy aristocratic family. But when her husband died, after only 2 years of marriage, Olympias interpreted this as a call from God to the single life. And thereupon, she devoted herself entirely to the care of the poor and the sick, using her wealth to that end. The members of her sisterhood carried out this caring work, as well as offering hospitality to travellers. In her early 30s, when John arrived in Constantinople, Olympias was a beautiful, highly intelligent, highly educated young woman with a passionate love of the Bible, which she read through over and over again, and a strong-minded character. John's predecessor, Bishop Nectarius, had ordained her as a deaconess. Female deacons were a settled feature of life in the early church, and they had the responsibility of caring specifically for Christian women. So when John became bishop, he and Olympias, bishop and deaconess, of course got to know each other, and a profound friendship quickly sprang up between them. They had close affinities, both intellectually and spiritually. Olympias became utterly devoted to John, taking care of his clothing and his meals. John was the only man allowed to enter the dwelling of the sisterhood, where, as their bishop, he would preach to the sisters. His inspired sermons, we are told, set their hearts ablaze with love for God. So here was a new positive relationship in John's life, which would endure to his death. J.N.G. Kelly, in his biography, says, "There was no one in Constantinople with whom John was to have a deeper or more sympathetic understanding. No one with whom he was to feel more at ease, or to whom he was to pour out his heart more unreservedly than this independent, strong-willed, but also intensely emotional woman." Let us be clear that there was never any hint of the slightest impropriety in their relationship. The bishop and the deaconess did not and would not, on principle, spend any time alone in each other's company. And they always addressed each other with an elaborate formality and courtesy. The friendship, from beginning to end, was purely platonic, a meeting of minds alone, never of bodies. Nonetheless, their mutual attachment was deep, affectionate, and lasting. There would never be anyone quite like Olympias in John's life. And in Olympias' life, there would never be anyone quite like John. The second new relationship in Constantinople was with the imperial family, the Emperor Arcadius and the Empress Eudoxia. Arcadius was only about 20 years old. Of slender build and stammering voice, he was a rather ineffectual personality, easily dominated by others. The one who dominated him was his wife, Eudoxia. She was a stunningly beautiful woman, a member of the Frankish tribe that gave its name to the land of France. Intelligent, spirited, and strong-willed, Eudoxia was also ambitious and much given to political intrigue. She ruled her husband with the aid of an inner circle of ladies of the court. Her religion had in it a powerful strain of superstition, which was to show itself in John's favour, as we shall see. Normally, Arcadius and Eudoxia worshipped in their private chapel, but on special occasions they joined the crowds to hear John preach in the Church of the Holy Wisdom. Now, at first, Arcadius and Eudoxia welcomed John as their new bishop and supported him. They were glad to see the church of the imperial capital made glorious by the presence of the East's greatest preacher. But things very shortly turned sour. The fact is that John's personality just did not fit into the corrupt and complex political world of the Eastern capital and its royal court. John was an intense, unworldly man who had neither taste nor talent for politics or intrigue. Nor did he change or tone down his preaching from the hard-hitting style that had marked his ministry in Antioch. The great ladies of the court who surrounded Eudoxia were the first to turn against their new bishop. They did not take kindly to the uncompromising stance he took on how the affluent should conduct themselves, and they especially reacted against his forthright pulpit comments on Christian women who entered church looking more like tarted-up hussies come to display their plumage than chaste handmaids of Christ come to adore the thrice holy God. The cronies of the empress, having thus conceived a toxic enmity for John, it was not long before they poisoned Eudoxia's own mind against him. Although she was held in check for a while by her superstitious awe of the great preacher. But once Eudoxia herself had begun to turn against John, he could expect little help from the emperor, who was totally under his wife's thumb. What seems to have sealed John's fate with Eudoxia was a sermon he preached in the year 401. In which he expounded the story of Naboth's vineyard from 1 Kings 21, vigorously denouncing Jezebel for her pivotal role in the seizure of the vineyard. It happens that Eudoxia had just engaged in a similar piece of unscrupulous behavior, seizing the vineyard of a poor widow. John spoke of Jezebel's sin in such a way that most people were sure he was really referring to Eudoxia, seeking to use the biblical story to arouse the conscience of the empress. All he aroused was her wrath. However, the dislike of Eudoxia and her circle of court ladies could not by itself have ruined John. They could work against him only through factions in the church. Unfortunately, a powerful anti-John faction did indeed develop among the Eastern clergy and monks. Now, mostly this was because, after being installed in Constantinople, John used the full weight of his authority as bishop to try to compel the clerics and monastics of the imperial city and the whole surrounding region of Asia Minor to live up to his own high ideals of Christian life and ministry. Many of them were simply unwilling to do this. John therefore made bitter enemies by his reforming zeal. For instance, soon after taking up his new position, John carried out a drastic purge of the clergy of Constantinople, sacking a number, including two of his deacons, who it seems had been found guilty of sexual sin and murder. This white-hot moral fervour of John was a shocking, electrifying contrast to the easy-going ways of his predecessor, Bishop Nectarius. If it won John the devotion of some like-minded friends, like Olympias, it earned for him much more the hostility of many foes, men who were not prepared to tolerate such a dedicated reformer as their bishop. Two enemies John made in particular were Constantinople's foremost monk, Abbot Isaac, and Bishop Severian of Gabala. Isaac was described by one of John's closest disciples, Palladius, as Isaac the little Syrian, the layabout, troop leader of bogus monks who has worn himself out with his incessant slander of bishops. Isaac had more or less been running the monasteries of Constantinople as a private fiefdom, a law unto himself. Once John made it clear that from now on, Abbot Isaac was under the authority of his bishop, Isaac became John's deadly enemy. As for Bishop Severian of Gabala, he was, like John, from Syria, a good preacher, whom John had welcomed in Constantinople, introduced to the royal court, and, when John was away, given his own pulpit, or ambo, to preach from. However, when John arrived back in Constantinople from a lengthy spiritual visitation of the western coast of Asia Minor, his deacon, Serapion, informed him that in his absence, Severian, who'd been filling in for John, had shamefully misused his position to try to undermine John's authority and promote himself. He had become a favourite with Eudoxia. John, who placed great confidence in Deacon Serapion, acted swiftly and ordered Severian to leave Constantinople. Eudoxia intervened, ordering Severian's immediate return. Things became very ugly, with the mass of ordinary people taking John's side. A patched-up reconciliation was ultimately contrived, but from that point onwards, Severian hated John and was at the heart of all intrigue to topple him. However, John's deadliest foe was not in Constantinople at all. This was Theophilus, Bishop of Alexandria. Alexandria had been the most important church in the East, the home of the great Athanasius. But in recent times, Constantinople had begun to outshine Alexandria. After all, Constantinople was the imperial capital. And now, with such a famous preacher as John as its bishop, Constantinople had thrown Alexandria quite into the shade. Theophilus resented this deeply and was determined to do anything he could to destroy the position of Constantinople's bishop. Theophilus also had personal reasons for disliking John, because John had given hospitality to four Egyptian monks, known from their height as the Tall Brothers, whom Theophilus had condemned. The controversy over the Tall Brothers is too complicated for us to enter into. Suffice it to say that it kindled malevolent passions and did more than anything else to inflame Theophilus against John. Theophilus must be one of the most unattractive characters in early church history. F.W. Farrar calls him the detestable Theophilus. His only virtue seems to have been a dazzling talent for scheming against his enemies and flattering and bribing others to take his side. By the year 403, John had stirred up so many adversaries, both in the court and among the clergy and monks, that Theophilus saw his moment to strike had arrived. He left Alexandria and travelled in person up to Asia Minor to complain about John's treatment of the Tall Brothers. He made it clear that he was on his way to the court to depose John. Theophilus had laid his plans with great thoroughness. He sent ahead of him a whole squadron of Egyptian bishops to act as his bloodhounds. He journeyed by land, not by sea, so that he could visit as many churches as possible, using every trick to mobilize the clergy against John. Once Theophilus arrived in Constantinople, he took up residence in a palace owned by Eudoxia and spent the next 3 weeks vigorously lobbying anyone who had a grievance against John, including Abbot Isaac, the troop leader of Constantinople's monks, and the embittered Severian of Gabala. These men were both fully involved in the plot. At length, in September 403, Theophilus convened a council of bishops in the city of Chalcedon, not far from Constantinople. The council was presided over by a one-time confidant of John's, Bishop Paul of Heraclea, who had now turned against his old friend. 29 accusations against John were submitted by the two deacons he had deposed on his first arrival in Constantinople. and a further 17 accusations were brought by Abbot Isaac. Some of these allegations were patently absurd to anyone who knew John, such as love of money, gluttony, sexual impropriety with women, even punching his enemies in the mouth during Holy Communion. Other charges were based on intense personal rivalries, where John's words and actions were no doubt given the worst possible spin, such as the claim that he had called one of his critics a babbler and a little weirdo. Several times the council summoned John to appear, but he refused. He did not acknowledge the council's legality. At length, Theophilus and his accomplices pronounced John guilty, declared him to be deposed, and informed the court and the people of Constantinople of their decision. In informing the court, they added a further allegation that John had insulted the empress by calling her Jezebel. The emperor, Arcadius, immediately confirmed the council's verdict. This was the ideal opportunity for the court to get rid of the troublesome bishop. Soldiers were dispatched to arrest John, but the ordinary people of Constantinople were passionately devoted to him, and they rose in protest, surrounding the Church of the Holy Wisdom by day and night, preventing the soldiers from getting anywhere near their beloved bishop. John, however, decided that he could not endanger the lives of his people or the tranquility of the city by resisting the emperor. So a few days later, he secretly slipped out of the church and surrendered to the authorities. They bundled him onto a ship, and it sailed away to the market town of Prynitus on the southern coast of the Black Sea. However, within days, before the ship could get any further, Arcadius and Eudoxia did a remarkable about-face, cancelled John's banishment, and recalled him. This was as a result of some disaster that struck the capital. Some sources say it was an earthquake. Others that Eudoxia, who was pregnant, gave birth to her child stillborn. Whatever the nature of the calamity, Eudoxia seems to have been terrified that this was God's judgment on her for having exiled John. So the troops were ordered to bring him back. John re-entered Constantinople in triumph, the people thronging the streets in their myriads and cheering. The bishop had won his first contest with the emperor and empress. Theophilus of Alexandria, his scheming in ruins, slunk back to Egypt, complaining that the people of Constantinople had been so enraged against him that he was in fear of his life. But John's victory was not to last. Just a few months later, in November 403, Eudoxia had a silver statue of herself set up near the Church of the Holy Wisdom, and the wild games and festivities around the statue disturbed the services of worship. John broke off from his prepared sermon to express his strong disapproval of the ungodly tumult and to condemn those who had organized it. A report of John's utterances was sent to the court. Eudoxia was once again enraged against John and again began scheming for his downfall. The breach of relationships between John and the imperial couple was so deep that they refused to receive Holy Communion at his hands in the special Christmas service that year. Theophilus of Alexandria scented his chance to intervene again and wrote to Arcadius and Eudoxia, dredging up an old ruling by a council held in Antioch 60 years previously, which stated that a bishop deposed by a council could not resume his responsibilities without first being exonerated by another council. John had resumed his responsibilities in defiance of this ruling, therefore he had no right to act as bishop and must be summarily removed from office. Theophilus's argument carefully ignored the fact that his council at Chalcedon that had deposed John had itself possessed no validity in church law. and that its sentence had not been carried out by the church, but by the government. The imperial couple, however, seized on Theophilus' argument as a pretext for ridding themselves once again of John. First, Arcadius had John put under house arrest. But Easter was fast approaching, the time in the early church calendar when all new converts, catechumens, as they were called, were baptized en masse. John, the clergy loyal to him, and the great body of his people, decided that these baptisms should go ahead, despite John's absence. The clergy hostile to John persuaded the authorities to put a stop to these proceedings. They were determined not to let John's church function in his absence. So a Saturday evening fell, and the baptismal service began. A detachment of 400 soldiers broke into the church. J.N.D. Kelly describes what happened. There followed extraordinary scenes of brutality and sacrilege, with officiating clergy being driven out with cudgels, women catechumens who had undressed in preparation for immersion fleeing half naked, the water in the fonts turned red with the blood of the wounded. The next day, Easter Sunday, the desecrated church stood deserted. The congregation had gathered instead in the public baths. But once again, the imperial stormtroopers attacked them and drove them out. Some of the clergy, and even more lay people, were thrown in prison. John himself remained under house arrest for a further 2 months, during which at least one attempt was made to assassinate him, not by the emperor or empress, but almost unbelievably, by his clerical enemies. The government seems to have been paralysed over this period, shaken to the core by the mass popular support for John. Eventually, however, John's foes among the clergy persuaded Arcadius to send him away into exile again. John could have raised the mob against the emperor, but he meekly submitted to the injustice. There was an emotional farewell in the Church of the Holy Wisdom between John and his committed followers among the bishops, presbyters, and deacons, and a more private parting in the baptistry between himself and faithful Olympius and three other deaconesses. Then the soldiers escorted him to a ship and to his second exile. The ship took John once again along the southern coast of the Black Sea, at length to Armenia, where he was to remain under constant military guard for 3 years, dragged about from one city, town, or village to another. He kept in touch with his supporters in Constantinople by letter, especially with Olympias. 17 of his letters to her have survived, and are generally regarded as being the most fascinating items from John's exile. J.N.D. Kelly says, "The letters reveal, with a vividness which has few parallels in ancient correspondence, the intimacy and deep mutual trust which bound together these two remarkable spirits. Their close rapport is evident in the naturalness with which John pours out all the minute incidents of his daily life, the ups and downs of his health, his reaction to the cruel Armenian winter. It comes out again in his eagerness to hear from her, in his restless interest in her health, in the desolation he feels when letters fail to arrive from her." Here's John comforting Olympius in one of these letters. "Even when I look at these calamities, I do not abandon the hope of better things, considering as I do who the pilot is in all this. Not one who gets the better of the storm by his art, but calms the raging waters by his rod. But if he does not accomplish this at the outset and speedily, such is his custom. He does not at the beginning put down these terrible evils, but when they have increased and come to extremities, and most people are reduced to despair, then he works wondrously and beyond all expectation, thus manifesting his own power and training the patience of those who undergo these calamities. Do not therefore be cast down, For there is only one thing, Olympias, which is really terrible, only one real trial, and that is sin. And I have never ceased continually harping upon this theme. But as for all other things, plots, enmities, frauds, calumnies, insults, accusations, confiscation, exile, the keen sword of the enemy, the peril of the deep, warfare of the whole world, or anything else you like to name, they are but idle tales. Do you see the abundance of resource belonging to God, his wisdom, his extraordinary power, his loving kindness and care? Do not, therefore, be dismayed or troubled, but continue to give thanks to God for all things, praising and invoking him, beseeching and supplicating. Even if countless tumults and troubles come upon you, even if tempests are stirred up before your eyes, let none of these things disturb you, for our Master is not baffled by the difficulty. Even if all things are reduced to the extremity of ruin, it is possible for him to raise those who have fallen, to convert those who are in error, to set straight those who have been ensnared, to release those who have been laden with countless sins, and make them righteous, to quicken those who are dead, to restore luster to decayed things, and freshness to those which have waxed old. Now, Olympias needed such words of encouragement because the situation in Constantinople was grim during John's exile. A new bishop for the Church of the Holy Wisdom had been appointed, but the majority would have nothing to do with him, remaining loyal to John and meeting in the open air for worship. Many of John's supporters were subjected to brutal government persecution, including Olympias, who was punished with a crippling fine when she steadfastly refused to acknowledge the new bishop. John was her bishop, whether in Constantinople or in exile. The divisions in the church spread far beyond the capital city, with clergy and people lining up either behind John or behind his opponents, splitting many a congregation. These divisions were not to be fully healed for another 30 years. Early in 407, Arcadius and Eudoxia decided to intensify the misery of John's exile by deporting him to the remote, inhospitable fortress town of Pityus on the furthest eastern extremity of the empire. The military escort was instructed to show no regard for John's well-being. So he was forced to march the great distance on foot, and was deliberately exposed to a deadly combination of scorching sun and lashing rain. After 3 weeks of this treatment, John collapsed, still some way from Pityus, at a hamlet called Bizeri. Racked with fever, his skin baked as red as a brick, John died within hours of his collapse, aged 58. His last words were, "Glory be to God for all things." 31 years later, in the year 438, the Emperor Theodosius II, son of Arcadius and Eudoxia, brought John's remains back to Constantinople. He publicly begged forgiveness for the terrible sin of his parents and had the saint's bones buried in the imperial capital in the Church of the Holy Apostles, the traditional burial place for bishops and emperors. The whole city turned out to celebrate the vindication of their beloved bishop's memory. The tables had now turned conclusively. No one could now be found to vilify John. The homecoming of his bones ended the divisions in the churches of the East. And from that time to the present day, the Universal Church has recognized John as one of its most luminous stars, a bishop of pure character and steely integrity, a patient martyr for his Lord, a biblical preacher never surpassed in holy eloquence, John of the Golden Mouth. F.W. Farrar calls him one of the noblest, wisest, and most eloquent of the fathers. If he had a fault, It was lack of tact. He could be painfully and perhaps needlessly blunt in calling a sin a sin. But that surely was a small spot in a bright and gallant sun. John may not have been a great theologian, like Athanasius or Augustine. He did not sway the destiny of nations and cultures, as Luther and Calvin were to do. But as a servant of Christ, who both eloquently preached and intensely lived practical Christianity, and won the passionate affection and loyalty of the common man, John Chrysostom has had very few equals. We shall allow C.H. Spurgeon to have the last word. Hath it not been told you concerning Chrysostom, the golden-mouthed, how whenever he preached, the church was thronged with attentive hearers, and there, standing and lifting up holy hands, he spake with a majesty unparalleled the word of God in truth and righteousness, the people listening, hanging forward to catch every word, and anon breaking the silence with the clapping of their hands and the stamping of their feet, then silent again for a while, spellbound by the mighty orator, and again carried away with enthusiasm, springing to their feet, clapping their hands, and shouting for joy again. Numberless were the conversions in his day. God was exceedingly magnified, for sinners were abundantly saved.